We're talking workforce and pandemic pocketbook issues here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. As the class of 2020 hit the workforce, the prospects for new college grads, they plummeted amid the pandemic. An economist with the job site ZipRecruiter told NPR last week that job postings for entry-level positions fell by 73% compared to before the pandemic struck. And openings for internships, very hard to come by. Did you graduate into this recession? What is your reality like now? What questions do you have about managing debt and navigating unemployment? We're at 800-642-1234. Cliff Robb is an associate professor of consumer science and faculty director of consumer finance and financial planning at UW-Madison. Cliff, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, we see millions of people who have filed for unemployment since the beginning of the year. Jobs are very, very scarce. What can people do without a stable source of income right now? What should they be thinking about?
Well, I think this is a time when you really want to be strategic about the types of obligations that you might be facing as a household. Think about how you want to manage some of the challenges. So a lot of people are facing difficulties with either managing a mortgage or managing their rent. Certainly those are the big payments in most people's lives. They may also be dealing with things like student loan debt, other existing debts that they've kind of accumulated previously. These are all challenges. And in some cases, there's relief programs to assist. But it's really important that households recognize that even if they're eligible for certain relief programs or support programs, usually what those programs are going to do is simply delay payment requirements.
Oh, kick the can down the road.
Yeah, it's much more of a right now you're going to get a break, but you're still going to be on the hook for any delayed payments. Now, one of the nice things about these benefits is they're usually going to keep that interest rate accumulation from happening. So they might give you like a period of 0% interest. So you're not seeing your payments grow with extra interest in there, but you still owe the same money you owed.
Forbearance. Let's talk about forbearance when your mortgage servicer, your lender allows you to pause, hit the pause button, or reduce your mortgage payments for a limited period of time while you get that financial footing. What should we be aware of regarding forbearance?
So with forbearance, first, I think it's really important to understand I would encourage anyone who is a mortgage holder to, if you aren't really familiar with who owns your mortgage, this is the time to check. So you can look at that and you can figure out who is actually servicing or holding that mortgage. If it's federally or governmentally, backed by a government-sponsored enterprise, you have a few more supports and provisions in place because the CARES Act was very specific about federally backed mortgages.
Like Fannie Mae, for instance?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, like FHA, VA, USDA, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, those would all count in most cases as being government-sponsored enterprises. And so they have a little bit more protections in terms of the forbearance model. But you can contact your lender directly. And my professional opinion is that you should be just very frank with them. It's always a hard conversation to have if you're truly struggling with finances. But in this kind of condition, this is when it's best to be straightforward and honest with your lender and see what kinds of supports they have, because there's usually a lot of options.
How might forbearance be repaid? What would the scenario look like?
So that's another case where you really have to discuss with your individual lender, because it really can vary. And I think it's really important before someone takes on a forbearance model, one of the most important things is understanding the repayment obligations, because it does not necessarily have a universal model to it. In most cases, they'll allow some kind of catch-up model where you can make maybe additional payments onto your existing mortgage up to a point in which you've paid back the backlog. And that might allow you a longer term of periodic payments to catch up. Some cases, they may be really requesting that you have an ability to repay in a larger sum. And that could be really difficult for a lot of households. So it's really important to understand that you're not being forgiven if you go into a forbearance model. The payments are not forgiven. You may not be having interest accumulate, but you will owe those same mortgage payments. Like the same amount of money will be paid to the mortgage holder over the term of the loan.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Cliff Robb, an expert on financial decision-making, college student financial behavior, and financial satisfaction and well-being. You can join in with your questions. Have you been experiencing a financial strain amid the pandemic? What has it been like for you and your family? Have you filed for unemployment insurance? What do you worry about most? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@WPR.org. Cliff, in the first couple months of the pandemic, it was teen and young adult employment that fell at twice the rate of overall employment. How might losing a job during a time of uncertainty affect the younger generation, young people at this time?
Well, I think there are some, it's not ideal, obviously. So it's not great to kind of graduate into a recession or a down economic market. But the nice thing is that those individuals do have the benefit of the long term. And so I think there's a lot more flexibility in the younger years. So a lot of people coming out of college, while they may have had a specific degree program they were studying, they may still be very flexible with regard to long-term employment prospects. They may still have a lot of different things they're interested in trying. And so this gives you that kind of sense that there is still flexibility there. I think it's much harder for workers that were kind of maybe closer to retirement, but still not desiring to retire yet, if they found themselves in a position where they might be laid off or unemployed, getting back in at that phase, I think, is a bigger challenge. Mm-hmm. It's still, I think, not a positive that we have so many young Americans struggling to find steady employment. But I think there are some aspects of it that make it a little bit easier on that group.
Yeah, and when you mention the flexibility of young Americans, younger people may also have more flexibility in moving around the country, literally geographically, where they're not tied to a specific area because of family obligations. They may be able to go where that job is calling them or in, perhaps finding a better market.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think that's really up to personal taste, obviously. But yeah, they have a little bit more flexibility typically in that condition. Now, I deal with lots of students graduating every year. And it's always interesting to me to see that there's this great blend of some that really have their mindset on where they want to be. Many of them, it is kind of regional to where they grew up, but some are really open to just being wherever the work is. So I think that it kind of varies person to person.
We're talking about battling the effects of unemployment and financial hardship caused by the pandemic. We have expertise from UW-Madison Associate Professor of Consumer Science, Cliff Robb. Were you getting your career established when COVID struck? What is the status of your career and work? What prospects are you faced with in employment? Are you looking to move? What could help you give clarity right now in your situation? There's space to talk. 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with Cliff Robb here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about financial challenges, especially debt in these turbulent times. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. President Trump extended student loan relief, originally scheduled to end at the end of September, now deferred through the end of 2020, if his executive action holds. Payments for federal student loans are deferred, but private student loan borrowers won't receive federal protections. What questions do you have about managing education loans? What do you want guidance on in juggling multiple types of loans and what to prioritize? It's 800-642-1234. You can join in. Cliff Robb is a faculty director of consumer finance and financial planning at UW-Madison, and he stays with us. So, Cliff, you watch a lot of young adults who graduate into the workforce with student loan debt, and what advice would you offer them?
Well, I think it's always a something to be cognizant of when you're graduating. Again, being informed is your first best step. So knowing who is it that owns your loan, right? Because in a lot of these cases, similar to what we talked about earlier with the mortgage forbearance rules, who owns the loan really matters. So a lot of the protections provided in the CARES Act and potentially extended in the executive order are for loans that are owned by the Department of Education. So if your loan is owned by the Department of Education, that would usually be a direct loan, but it could be FFEL, Perkins, HEAL loans. But a lot of those other loans could also be owned by other lenders. So you want to check that. You can go to studentaid.gov. If you use your FSA ID, you can look up who actually owns your loan. So I consider that to kind of be an important first step, just to kind of see what relief are you eligible for. If your loan is not owned by the federal government, i.e. the Department of Education, I would still encourage people to directly contact their lender to ask what types of programs are being offered or what kind of supports are available in terms of relief and forbearance under those models if you need it.
Is it a good idea for new grads to start paying off student loans right after college?
I think it is. I think it's really important to kind of have that as a part of your rhythm. I don't necessarily pressure or encourage people to feel like that has to be where almost all your resources are going. I know some people are very averse to debt, and there's nothing wrong with that attitude. And so some people are aggressively wanting to pay that off as quickly as possible before they do other things. I think there can be balance. I think it's okay to view those loans as a little bit longer term debt, because usually they're pretty low interest rates associated with them. And it was an investment in your income growth potential. So I kind of take aside that, yes, starting to make payments immediately is a good thing. If you're in a unique situation under the current, health crisis, it's not terrible if you need to delay those payments. But I would encourage anyone that even if you have the ability to pay partially, it's a nice thing to do, because right now, if you're under a forbearance model, there's no interest growth and those payments are typically going to premium. And so that's a nice thing to kind of continue payments if you can under the current model.
We are talking with Cliff Robb, an expert on financial decision-making, college student financial behavior, and financial satisfaction, guiding us today on the current situation amid the pandemic and how to deal with debt, how to deal with mortgages, rent. You can join in with your financial question, 800-642-1234. Cliff, how might student loan debt affect your overall credit score?
Well, I think, it can be a pretty significant impact if you are not keeping up. Now, obviously, the current model allows for, if you have, again, loans that are owned by the Department of Education, you've probably got some relief. You very likely have some sort of relief if you've talked to your lender, if you're in a position where it's difficult to pay them, because this is one of those cases where, just like any other financial obligation, a failure to meet your obligations, a failure to make those regular payments can really adversely impact your credit score. Because that's really, repayment is one of the biggest factors in determining what that score is. So being timely, making sure that you've kind of kept up, those are really critical pieces.
In terms of taking out credit cards or managing credit cards at this time of life, what would you say there?
That's really going to be a person-to-person decision. I'm not one that says credit cards are necessarily bad, but I do think credit cards have to be respected in the sense that in a lot of cases, people will view the credit limits provided by a lender as some sort of signal of what they can spend in the sense that, oh, I have this much money I can be spending. And really, it's not that. The lender is going to give you a pretty generous line of credit in most cases, especially once you're earning a noticeable, like, you know, you have an observed income they can look at. And so I think it's really important to kind of view credit cards as just another tool potentially in the arsenal, because if you do have a credit card that you're using responsibly, that can be a really nice factor that helps you build strong, positive credit. And making those regular payments, paying it off on a monthly basis, if you're using it in that way as a convenience tool, I think it's very positive. And it has a lot of potential perks and benefits in terms of some of the perks that might be attached to that card. If you're getting airplane miles, which aren't really useful right now, but you might also be getting things like cash back.
Right. Yeah. What about that debt to credit ratio? What should you think about there in terms of, you know, this is a card that gives you thousands of dollars. But how do you, what should you think about in that ratio?
I mean, I strive to say, try not to use more than 15%. I try not to also fix into these set rules because it really is condition to condition, person to person. But in general, if you're going to need to revolve a balance, I think you want to keep that as low as possible in terms of your overall available credit, how much you're actually carrying in debt. If you can keep that below 25 to 30%, I think that's really good. I try to keep it a little lower than that if necessary. But again, the ideal is no revolving credit. If you can get to that point where you're really just using the card as convenience, you're using it in such a way that you can easily pay it off each month. So you're just saving yourself the hassle of dealing with cash or checks. That's probably the best way to do it. If you want to treat it almost like it's a debit card, but since it has certain rewards, you like using it more than your debit card. But again, if you have to think about thresholds, you want to stay kind of below that 25 to 30% of consuming your debt relative to income, I think.
And I bet longevity also can be on your side. I was looking at one of my cards recently and it said 1993 on it. And I was like, wow, I've had this since 93. you know, that's a long time in a way. I would imagine if you've been a cardholder in good standing for decades, that too can help build credit.
It does. History is another big factor. So if you look at history, I have credit cards that one card in particular that I've kept because it was my first card and I don't ever use it. And it's almost like it's a bank account that's hardly touched, but it's, you know, decades old at this point.
Oh, and it's so sentimental. Come on.
Yeah, exactly. it helps the score. So I do encourage, like, yeah, if you're getting that first card, don't feel like you have to be obligated to stay with that lender forever. But I also don't necessarily feel the need to be like, you don't need to necessarily cut that card up or destroy that line of credit. You don't need to cancel that card. Now, if you don't want the temptation, you can let them mail you new cards and you can cut those new cards up without actually shutting down the account. You don't have to use the cards.
You can keep that account open, that credit card account open and just, you know, have it linger there if you have that discipline that you're not going to touch it unless you absolutely need to.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so, you know, is there, I know you're saying no rule of thumb on anything, but having too many cards an issue or, you know, having too many lines of credit open, would that be an issue?
I think it's in the long run, not really. what would be the big, what would happen if you were trying to open lots of cards early on all at once, that's going to flag your account because any request for credit is kind of a tick. And so there's a flag that goes up when you request credit. And I faced this when I was younger because I remember I had just bought a home. I had just done a couple other things. Like, yeah, I was doing all these things that, that involved use of my credit. And I remember after I bought my home, I was like, well, now I have to go to like Lowe's/Home Depot and get like my homeowner's card, right? And I have to go get this card there. And I was denied a card because that there have been too many recent pulls on my credit report.
Ah, sure. We're looking at economic relief in the pandemic, how to approach money emergencies with Cliff Robb. He's an associate professor of consumer science at UW-Madison. You can join in with your questions about money, 800-642-1234. We'll get back to this after a news update here on the Ideas Network. We're spending the hour on pocketbook issues amid the pandemic. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Congress's federal eviction moratorium ended in July. Wisconsin's moratorium ended in late May. While President Trump announced executive orders last weekend, including one to prevent evictions, it's unclear whether it will keep people in their homes. According to the COVID-19 Eviction Defense Project, 30 to 40 million people in the U.S. could be at risk of eviction in the coming months. Have you filed for unemployment insurance? What do you worry about most? Are you saving for a down payment? Is home ownership out of reach? Join in at 800-642-1234. Cliff Robb is an associate professor of consumer science and faculty director of consumer finance and financial planning at UW-Madison, and he stays with us. We were talking earlier there about mortgages, Cliff. I'm wondering, what would you say to renters, for people who are renting? What kinds of programs or thinking should be going on right now if you do rent and have a landlord?
Yeah, so similar to the issue with mortgages, it does matter kind of the nature of your rental agreement, right? So if you are in federal subsidized or backed housing, you have more protections than individuals who just are renting from maybe a private landlord. So those eviction protections were extended to August 31st. If you have federal subsidized or federally backed housing. But I do think what's most important, this was what I would tell anyone. It's the same for a mortgage borrower. If you're a renter, my first thing I would do if I was struggling with repayment would be to contact and talk with the landlord. And I think working with your landlord is the first best step, because in most cases, they aren't looking to flip the unit. You know, so you think about it, they're much happier with a tenant, even a tenant that might be struggling to make their regular payments, than trying to find a new one. So in a lot of cases, I think starting with your landlord is like the best step.
And in terms of that strategy of talking with the landlord, having that conversation, what should be your goal here? Should it be to reduce the amount you owe each month, your rent, or should it be trying to say, hey, give me a couple months free? I mean, you know, what would be a legitimate request?
Yeah, I think it's really going to depend on your situation. I do think the number one thing you could do is just be as open as possible. If you've faced significant income changes due to the current global health crisis, there's no reason not to be completely straightforward and open about that. It's also a good idea to talk about, like, come to the conversation informed. So go and see what are the local or state-based relief programs or assistance programs you may be eligible for. So Wisconsin's Department of Housing and Economic Development, or the WEDA, has a lot of resources out there for individual renters as well as lenders or borrowers. So if you come to the table by saying, I've already done some of these things, I found some assistance programs, and then you come with ideas, I definitely wouldn't suggest that it's likely you'll get any kind of like pure relief in the sense that they'll just forgive payments. But talking about strategies for over time, making back that obligation, I think that's a really good strategy. And most landlords, I believe, are going to be very open to that.
What would be your suggestion for balancing utilities and internet on top of your rent and juggling those payments and how to prioritize them versus your rent?
Yeah, that's always the challenge, right? So it's figuring out which ones have the most flex. And in some cases, you know, I would look at what programs are available within each category. Now, I think it's worth plugging the website for Wisconsin.gov. The Department of Workforce Development has put together a really nice set of resources related to COVID-19. And it kind of gives anyone who's struggling with questions about financial management or resources that might be available to them some nice points of contact. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, go kind of going down these lists of resources and figuring out where you would stand with each one. And what you're saying is invest in that time on the front end so you can really start putting together a plan when you do go to talk with your lender or your landlord.
Yeah, it's just going to make a stronger case for you. And you've got to advocate for yourself. So if you come to the landlord with just I've lost income and I have no ideas, that's going to be a much tougher conversation. If you're truly just like, I don't know what to do and I don't have any money, which I think many people struggle with. I think that's a common problem. So it is very difficult to say, and I don't mean to make it sound like, oh, you don't do that, but you're in a much better situation if you come with the information of knowing that, hey, these kinds of programs exist. I'm reaching out to this office and this support program, and here's the kinds of steps I'm taking to make sure that within the next, say if it's 2 or 3 months, you know, in the next 2 or 3 months, this is my strategy for kind of getting back into a stable financial situation where I feel very comfortable I can stay in this, in the current housing situation.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Cliff Robb, who is an expert on financial decision making, college student financial behavior, and financial satisfaction and well-being. You can join in with your questions amid the COVID situation. Are you having trouble affording essentials like housing or like food? How have you been managing financially during the last 5 months? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Cliff, we've been talking about hanging on to housing, but there are circumstances where there are people looking to buy in this market who are preparing to put money down for a home. If you're considering a purchase of a home right now, what should you bear in mind?
Well, interest rates are historically low, so it's not, in my opinion, it's not a terrible thing to be doing. I think it's always just kind of know the market you want to buy in, right? So if you've really been strategic about saving up and you've got an idea of what it is you want out of a home, really know the marketplace that you're buying in, because you want to buy somewhere where you feel like that home value is going to stay strong or continue to grow. And so that's usually our most concerning factor. I think if someone's in the position to buy, this is a really great market to buy in. And it is a condition where lenders are willing to lend, interest rates are low, and I don't see any drawbacks to making that decision at this point, as long as you're kind of fully aware of kind of the distinct aspects of location you're looking at.
What would you suggest for a down payment?
I try to stick to the 20% rule. Mm-hmm. I know it's a hard rule to get to sometimes. More is great if you have it, but I really think getting to that minimum 20%, because you're going to just save yourself in unnecessary fees over the long run. If you're under that 20%, you're going to be paying the lender private mortgage insurance, which is basically just the lender's recognition that you are slightly riskier and potentially could break the agreement at some point in the future. And so they're getting that little bit of extra compensation for your slightly more risky mortgage than somebody who's got 20% down.
What are your feelings about going toward a 30-year mortgage or a 15-year mortgage? What do you think?
That is always a tough one. I can just lay out the realities. Again, every person's going to pick their own process. But obviously, with a 15-year mortgage, you're typically going to have a larger monthly payment. You're going to pay less interest over the life of the loan because it's a shorter time frame. So the reality is it's going to be less expensive in the long run compared to a 30-year mortgage on the same home. 30-year mortgage is nice for a lot of people because it maybe allows you to get in a little bit more house than you might be able to afford under the 15-year model because of the condensed payments in the 15-year program. So it really is going to depend on situation. If somebody's comfortable making that commitment, if they feel like they found the right house and they couldn't afford it under the 15-year plan, going to that 30-year mortgage to get into that home, if it's worth the extra cost to you, I think that's fine. I think that's something that people should just feel they should be informed about, knowing that, like, mm-hmm. this is what it's going to cost extra to have that extra period of time in which I'm in the home.
Remember in the last financial crisis, the housing crisis, where adjustable rate mortgages went berserk. What do you see there with ARMs?
I mean, ARMs are still, to me, a little high risk.
Okay.
In the sense that because there's no guarantees what the future holds for interest rate markets. Like, I don't know what interest rates are going to be in 5 years from now. I don't know what they're going to be next year. I have guesses at that, and they're, you know, modestly informed guesses, but I would not put much confidence behind them. So that's, to me, the challenge. Like, with an ARM, you're usually going to get in a little bit lower interest rate for that introductory period, whether it be a 5 year or 7 year introductory period. But after that, the interest rates go where they go. Now, the ARMs are going to have caps in place, and they're going to have provisions that it won't just, like, skyrocket on you. But even a slight adjustment up can have a significant impact on your monthly payment.
UW-Madison Consumer Finance Faculty Director Cliff Robb is our guide to money issues amid the pandemic. Still time for your situation. Are you having trouble amid the pandemic with money issues? How have you been managing in these months? How would you characterize your circumstances now compared to back in March? Still time to talk with your money situation, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Cliff Robb here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation now with Cliff Robb. He's an associate professor of consumer science and faculty director of consumer finance and financial planning at UW-Madison. He's been our guide for money issues, money decisions amid the pandemic. And Cliff, are you ready? I've got a big question for you now. It is coming. Drum roll. I don't have a drum roll. But what would you say is your best money tip for people out there? What, any, you know, sky's the limit, just your best money tip.
I know that's such a great broad concept, right? Like, one thing you do, like, you get, there's entire books out there,
right,
you know, lists of, like, here's the things to do to take control of your money, and those lists may be like 50 items long. But, you know, in all honesty, what I would probably say is my thought is to kind of, it's a little bit about mindset. And so my thought process is, first, try not to be intimidated by financial decision making. Because one of the biggest failures we see in a lot of cases are people's their unwillingness to face the money matters head on And that's oftentimes what leads to larger problems in the long run.
Oh, very good. So, yeah. I want to pause here and take Diane in Watertown. Diane, hi.
Good morning. I have a question about college students and credit card debt. We have two college students. They've been authorized users on our credit card, which, by the way, ours says 1991, so we've had it quite a long time. We have always paid the balance in full every month, and it is our primary payment thing. The only thing we don't use it for is, like, tips in a restaurant or small local businesses. We try to pay in cash. But otherwise, so we have some months $6,000, but I pay it off every month. But because there's a 10-day difference between the end of the cycle and when the payment is due, my one daughter has noticed her credit score drop because it says she has this credit debt. Because so our bill is due on the 8th, but on the 23rd, the statement closes. And I've always only paid off the statement amount because I felt I should keep the extra several thousand in the bank. But that appears to affect her credit score. Does that seem right?
That, you know, that's something I would definitely maybe talk to your card company about, because that doesn't seem like it should be happening, particularly given that, in all honesty, when somebody's an authorized user on a card, they're getting very little credit anyway in terms of credit score, because it's known by the credit rating agencies that that individual is essentially piggybacking on someone else's good credit. So, you know, and it's not a bad way to start. I think it's a great idea to have your children beginning to function with credit that way, because it does offer them experience. And being an authorized user does have some value, but it really shouldn't be causing a negative hit. And I think what I would do is also pull her actual credit report. And that can be done for free pretty much from...
Right, and that's where she saw that this is happening. And she wants me to pay the entire balance each month. And, you know, so eventually I think it'll even out. But my point is that money's not due for another month, half of it usually.
Exactly, As long as you're meeting the balance required at the time, you should be okay. I would definitely talk to the card company about that first. And if not, you could consider actually talking to the credit reporting agency, because it could be a fault on there. They're not perfect. It'd be also interesting to know if that's something that's showing up consistently across multiple credit reporting agencies, or if it's just one.
So pull multiple agencies as well.
You can look at the three different big ones. That would be my first thought after talking to the card company.
Diane, thank you for that question. And Cliff, we're out of time. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, sure. Happy to be here.
Cliff Robb is an associate professor of consumer science and faculty director of consumer finance and financial planning at UW-Madison. And now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a victim of the coronavirus, a 28-year-old activist who advocated for youth in the foster care system. He's just one of the 1,000 Wisconsinites who've been killed by COVID-19.
Doshe DJ Joy really lived up to his name. He posted a video of himself on Facebook, and in it, Joy's giving a speech about some of the pain he experienced as a child in and out of foster homes in Milwaukee, and how he ultimately rose above the darkness.
The one thing you can never take away from me is the joy that I bring to so many people. I have been told by a friend that my smile brings bright light into a very dark room.
Joy's best friend, Teodolo De La Garza, says that was absolutely true.
Our friendship was like the bomb.
The two met at Springfield College in Milwaukee. As counselors, De La Garza says he and Joy challenged each other to be the best versions of themselves.
And he's like, I just want to help you grow in this area. It was always that. And I would say, like, you know what? I'm going to tell you right now, I'm probably not going to like what you're going to say. And if I get mad and I say something back, just know that it's because I'm not accepting what you're saying. But give me a few days and I'll come back and I'll tell you you're right.
Joy loved gospel music and was deeply religious. Recently, he was improving his health by going to the gym. He had a ton of friends and a relationship with his birth mother. De La Garza says Joy was unapologetically himself as a gay man.
And because he was able to just always be himself, I'm like, I don't know how he does it, but I want to do that too.
But advocacy and volunteer work were Joy's life. He taught people their rights, accompanied minors to court, and worked as a substance abuse counselor. Joy pushed to establish a group home for LGBTQ youth in Milwaukee.
He was bold.
Yeah.
That brother was awesome. Like, going the extra mile for people. And some people may have thought that he was doing too much, but in reality, he was just kind-hearted. It was always for the benefit of the community. It was always for the support of clients.
He was always the first to raise his hand and to have a story about the reason why this was really important and why we had to make some changes. So he was an advocate in the best possible way.
Wendy Henderson is the Division of Safety and Permanence Administrator with the Wisconsin Department of Children and Families. She worked with Joy on and off for about 10 years. He would speak on panels for the state and talk with judges or social workers about what it was like to be in out-of-home care.
There's nothing more powerful at a legislative hearing than hearing a young person talk about their own experience. And you take something that's the most traumatic experience of your life and then use that to try to make change in the system. That's a really hard tightrope to walk. And he did that well, and he held other people's hand while they did it.
Joy died of complications from COVID-19 in mid-May after spending about 2 weeks in the hospital.
It's just a tremendous loss, honestly, because I think he could have been a great addition to wherever he decided to put his energy.
Hi, coming to you live from Washington, D.C. to all my friends and family.
Joy took a trip to Washington, D.C. last year with a group of foster youth. While there, he developed a friendship with Congresswoman Gwen Moore of Milwaukee. They even spent holidays together. After Joy passed, she introduced legislation named in his honor that would allow former foster youth to stay on Medicaid until age 26.
That's his legacy. He wanted to change the laws.
De La Garza says Joy also wanted to pursue his master's degree and eventually open a group home to help youth overcome trauma. De La Garza deeply misses his best friend, and he still texts him. He'll send him updates about his job as an AODA therapist at the Milwaukee LGBT Center.
Let's see. Oh, it was on July 6th. I said, "Miss you, bro. I'm submitting my background check to the board to become credentialed nationally, like we always talked about. Miss you, bro. Wish me luck."
De La Garza now finds himself asking, what would Doshe do?
I'm still living in what he taught me, you know? Just this time it's by myself now, you know?
Doshe DJ Joy is just one of the 1,000 Wisconsinites who has died from COVID-19 this year. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And this project is a collaboration between WPR News and Wisconsin Life. Tomorrow, we'll bring you the story of a couple married for over 70 years who both died of COVID-19. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.